Live from KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. As urban meatpacking plants have moved to rural areas, the kids of immigrant and refugee workers often lack the support system that exists in urban areas, but they still have dreams.
I always promise him that I will be there to support the family and my siblings.
This week on Casey Currents, we talk about the challenges and opportunities these young people face in rural communities. Plus, if you live in Missouri, a new website makes it easy to find out how many gifts your state rep is accepting from lobbyists. And we visit a post office that honors local veterans.
You forget, unless it's Veterans Day and you have the holiday off, but this is a visual.
It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. And now we're live, so you can call in and share your thoughts on some of the big issues in our community. For many generations, meatpacking plants in Kansas City were a place where immigrants found a foothold in U.S. society. They worked difficult and dangerous jobs in those slaughterhouses, often with the hopes of securing a better future for their children. Now, in recent decades, meatpacking plants have continued to employ immigrants and refugees, but they've moved out of urban areas and into rural towns where there's less of a support system. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe and Abby Fentress-Swanson recently visited Knoll, Missouri and Garden City, Kansas to learn about the lives of rural immigrant and refugee children. You might have heard some of their stories on Morning Edition. On today's Casey Currents, we'll be talking about the challenges and opportunities facing rural immigrant kids. And we want to hear your thoughts at 816-235-2888. But to start us off, Peggy and Abby asked some of the teens and young adults they interviewed about their hopes for the future. Here's some of their responses.
My parents, they told me, you can get a job at the plants. But I told them... No, I heard of things about you always wake up hurt, you don't wake up right, basically. So that's why I'm working in the restaurant. I'd rather work in a restaurant than a chicken plant anytime. Right after high school, I will be going to college, and I will be the first of my family to go to college. That's what motivates me right now, to finish high school and everything.
I want to know how to speak English, how to improve English, but in my house, I have problem like nobody working, and I quit my school. I think when I come here, it's a bad thing for me. I want to back to Thailand, I want to pass my high school. I don't want to walk over there. I want to walk in hotel. Doctor, nurse, translator. I think one day when my sister already 18, I gonna go school. She said, don't worry, my brother. I gonna support you.
Actually, I dream to be an air hostess, like flight attendants. My parents don't let me. They want me to be a teacher. So now I changed my career to be a teacher. To be able to be successful in my future, I need to have education. The highest I could get, I will get it. At home, I am like teaching my father an English language, so that way he can learn how to write and read like some of it. And when we go back to Arizona, I plan to like apply a job for him as like at the market to be a cashier or maybe, I don't know, to be something. I don't want him to work hard at Tyson anymore. I always promise him that I will be there to support the family and my siblings. That's my dream, though.
I'm like 26 years old now. I'm single. I'm living with my dad and my mom, my brother. We would like to join college, me and my sister, but really we have been hard time to go there and study and come back home, go to work. 45-minute drive or 40-minute drive, we're gonna go up there. I'm working like here like 2 years and 9 months. I'm trainer, training the people how to cut chicken. That's a really, really difficult job. My mom, she do like packing the meat, and my dad, he wash floor. So I wish to go to Arkansas, Rogers, Arkansas, so that I can go to school up there. I wish I could be in graduate after 5 years college, then have better life with my family and get married.
You know, education is very expensive in Africa. You cannot even afford it. Better life and to look for a better education. That's why I come to look for here. I want to be a technician. I like stuff like engineering, the car, the engines, making new improvement, new ideas, new development.
We think when we go to the United States, it's 50-50. You're a girl, you could be anything you want. And that's the reason why. Because when we're in Vietnam, we're restricted with being like, people would be telling you, you're a girl, how can you do that and stuff. And it feels so nice to have that feeling when you're in America and you could tell people, I'm a girl, I could do anything I want.
Those were the voices of young people in their teens and 20s from Knoll, Missouri, and Garden City, Kansas. Their families are from Vietnam, Somalia, Burma, Thailand, and Mexico. And they were interviewed for Harvest Public Media's series In the Shadow of the Slaughterhouses, reported by Peggy Lowe and Abby Fentress Swanson. Abby is joining us from station KBIA in Columbia to tell us a little more about the issues they explored in the series. Abby, welcome to Casey Kearns.
Thanks, Sylvia.
So, Abby, why did you want to tell the stories of these young people?
Well, we actually got Peggy and I.
I think we lost Abby for a minute now just because of our phone connection, but I also want to welcome our other guest here from over the phone from Garden City is Deborah Bolton, a family life educator at Kansas State University Research and Extension. Thanks for joining us on Casey Currents.
Thank you, Maria, or Sylvia.
Sylvia Maria, is it? Thank you.
Sylvia Maria.
tell me, did you hear the stories of those young people that we just aired?
Yes.
Did that resonate?
It's consistent with the families that I work with. I'm a social researcher, and I've been doing multilingual research here in Finney County, Garden City. And what I do know is that the families that come here to work very hard, and they want the best things for their children. And, you know, it's what we call the American dream. We want to do well in life, we want to live in middle class, and we want our children to do well. And the families that I work with are just, they have those same dreams. And when you talk about some of the barriers, we do see some barriers for students. One, I heard the one young man say something about the family saying, go work in the beef packing plant. Well, I've worked with high school counselors that tell the boys, go work in a beef packing plant. You can make $13 an hour, which sounds like a lot of money if you consider someone working at mid-management coming from Mexico, for example, is making 190 pesos a day. That's about equivalent to $19 a day. So $13 an hour sounds like a lot until you start having a family and start having those obligations, which they find out in some cases a little late.
And how long have you been doing this kind of work in Garden City?
I would say for 20 years. I worked in Head Start for a long time, then I went to adult education for 11 years, and I was always working with the families, and now as an extension specialist and social researcher, I'm still working with families. This past summer, this has gotten some national attention, we started three bilingual, bicultural 4-H programs, and we were expecting maybe 30 people in a program, and we had 90 families, and we did 4-H with whole families, not just 7 years old and above.
That's interesting. Is that the first time that 4-H has been, there has been a bilingual and bicultural program?
I think so. I think so. And bilingual and bicultural was a really important thing to do because identification and self-identification is important in how the students view themselves. Yes, you're in a U.S. American society, but it's okay to be to feel proud of who you are and where you came from. And so that's where we call it bicultural, because they're in two cultures.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Are you from Garden City originally?
No, I grew up in the mountains of Colorado.
And do you have a sense of, I mean, how long has the immigrant community been an influence in Garden City? I mean, a long time, right?
Oh, a long time. Most recently, the 1980s is when the beef packing plants came, and that's when a pretty large influx of Hispanics and Southeast Asians came. But way before that, in the early 20th century, when the sugar beets and the railroads, at the agriculture, and then of course the railroad brought a mixture of multicultural populations, Hispanic, Germans, and they worked side by side. So Finney County has had a long, they've been integrating those communities a long time. So that's why Finney County is such a favorite place for researchers to come, because they keep asking the question, why does it work so well in Finney County when other counties that have a lot of the same demographics doesn't seem to work as well? But
and how do you answer that question?
I say it's the history. Look at history here. We know that immigrants are an asset for the kind of work that's done in Southwest Kansas, largely rural, largely agricultural. And I was talking to one of the Royal Farm Dairies, is the name of one of the dairies in town, and he says, you know, Southwest Kansas is an economic empire with beef processing and other agricultural. But the good thing is that we could not have done this without immigrant populations coming in, and they have the aptitude for the work. It's hard work. It's not work that we raise our children to do a lot necessarily, that I didn't, and I'm not interested in doing that work. And I think I'm like a lot of U.S. Americans, thinking that's just not the work I want to do or raise my children to do. So we have a population of people who don't mind doing the work.
And from what I understand, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Garden City has a similar history, let's say, to nearby Dodge City and Liberal, Kansas, that also have for quite a long time seen immigrants and the Latino population, really, that is almost, you know, really part of the history of that community. But those communities maybe have not been as successful in this integration and in helping these young people, you know, develop their futures.
Well, and I don't have the answer to why they are not. I've worked in those other communities, and I see that. I think that in some ways they're a more invisible community. The subcommunities are a little more invisible. That's only been my observation. I don't have any data to back that up, but I do have data to back up how we work with the populations in Finney County. And when you talk about supporting young students, we still do have a large dropout population because they don't feel successful in the schools. But and I know our schools work very hard on that, and I think part of it is qualitatively. Most of my work is quantitative, but I do go out and do interviews and to find some qualitative backup. For example, why are our students, our Latino students, leaving school before graduation? And I find that a lot of times the families are poor; they need someone to work. The parents didn't graduate themselves, so they only know this kind of work, so they think, well, maybe we don't need that. But as the parents start learning the importance and the difference between not having a high school degree or diploma and just getting one, what that does to raise the economic value of, you know, human capital, it's quite amazing. And that's something my research has really shown, the difference between not having a high school degree and and at least getting a high school.
And I want to bring in now our reporter from Harvest Public Media, Abby
okay.
Fentress Swanson. She's at KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. Abby, welcome to KC Currents.
Thanks, Sylvia.
And tell me, why did you want to tell the stories of these young people, you and Peggy Lowe, who did this series for Harvest?
Yeah, our reporting project actually started with a very generous grant that we got from the Institute for Justice in Journalism, and they sort of wanted us to focus on immigrant children, and we thought, how can we focus on immigrant children while still covering what we do best at Harvest, which is agriculture and food production issues. So we decided to look at the children of slaughterhouse workers because most of them are immigrant and refugee workers. And, you know, we'd seen a lot of stories about the adult workers, but we hadn't seen a lot of stories about children. And that kind of got us thinking about this sort of really invisible population of kids who are living in often small rural towns across the country, and they don't often have access to a lot of social services that such a new diverse population needs.
And that's different from the children of immigrants and refugees in cities?
Yeah, I mean, I think back in the day, immigrants mostly did settle in larger cities like Chicago and Kansas City, and that's where the meatpacking plants were too. But there's been a gradual trend, what experts call new immigration, which is immigrants settling outside of bigger cities, and that's where the meatpacking plants are too. And I did most of my reporting in a very small town in rural Missouri in southwest Missouri called Knoll. It's a town of about 1,800 people. And it's such a small, remote place that the nearest food pantry and free clinic are really miles away. And so you have this very diverse population of Mexican immigrants, Somalis, Burmese, Sudanese, workers and their families. And they just it's really hard for them to kind of get everything that they need because they're in this very small, remote place.
And when did that influx start in Knoll?
That started in the mid-90s. Hispanics moved first, some of them undocumented. There have been raids in Knoll before. And then Pacific Islanders, who I didn't mention before, they came next, followed by Somalis in the late 2000s. And now Burmese and Sudanese refugees are beginning to move to Knoll to take these jobs.
And what did you find is the climate towards welcoming new arrivals, immigrants and refugees, and particularly their children, as compared to what we're hearing about Garden City?
Yeah, I think Garden City, I mean, it's a much larger town. I think it's about 30,000 people, something like that. But I think Knoll has, when Mexicans first arrived in the mid-90s, I think it was probably way more difficult than it is now for immigrants. But the town has really struggled to try to embrace these newcomers. The Somalis I talked to, some of them, and said they'd really had a hard time fitting in and feeling welcome there. I talked to several people who'd had their tires slashed recently. And also there's a diner on Main Street, which is called Kathy's Country Kitchen with all K's. And I had been told by Somalis that they didn't feel welcome there. Their T-shirts sold inside that diner that say, "I got caught eating at the KKK." Huh. So things like that, particularly for the Somali population, I heard from them that, you know, had made it a little more difficult. That said, I think the schools are really trying hard to make this, all of the kids who are coming into town, feel welcome, certainly, and also address needs that they have. I mean, there are a dozen languages spoken there, and they work really hard on ELL learning. They send backpacks, like 40 backpacks full of food home with lots of kids every week. And they talk about immigration. It's kind of part of the school day now. So
you're listening to KC Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Later this hour, we're going to hear how a post office in Overland Park is honoring veterans. But now we're talking about the challenges and opportunities facing the children of immigrants who work in meatpacking plants in rural parts of Kansas and Missouri. We're joined by Harvest Public Media reporter Abby Fentress Swanson and Deborah Bolton, a family life educator and researcher with Kansas State University's Research and Extension Program. Do you live in a rural community with a slaughterhouse. How have immigrants affected life there? Join our conversation at 816-235-2888, or you can comment on KCUR's Facebook page. Deborah Bolton, you mentioned this idea of immigrants being invisible in some other communities, and maybe they're more visible in Garden City. What does that look like?
I would say it's integrated, more integrated, and that's when we say invisible. You know, you're not seeing other communities celebrating, for example, Fiesta together. And my observation has been, if you were looking at social capital, for example, what are the things where everybody is involved? The schools are a great equalizer, where it doesn't matter for school programs and school sports. Non-Anglos and Anglos participate at about the same rate. And in churches, non-Anglos and Anglos participate in about the same rate. So we see that those social institutions are great equalizers. And when you see that kind of count, you see that a community is integrated. For parades, for example, we have the Beef Empire Days Parade. Everybody comes out for that. It doesn't matter what the ethnicity doesn't. The ethnic people and non-ethnic people, or Anglo and non-Anglo, participate at about the same rate. So we see that as great integration.
And Abby, now, I just wonder. Oh, go ahead, Deborah.
Well, your focus has been more on the children, I've noticed, and I think the children integrate much easier than the adults, since they learn English so quickly. The further you get away from puberty, the harder it is to gain another language, learn a second language, and it's a little harder for the adults, so they don't integrate as quickly as the youth.
And Abby, in doing this reporting along with Peggy Lowe, who is the one who went to Garden City, I wonder, what did you see that Noel is not doing or doesn't have that Garden City is?
Well, my understanding from many conversations with Peggy is that schools are only part of the safety net in Garden City, whereas I felt like in Noel, without those schools, it would have been really, really tough on newcomers coming there because, you know, these schools provide dental cleanings, glasses. They do trauma. They brought in a private provider to do trauma counseling for some of these children. And they do help provide legal assistance when families need it. There's no community center in Noel. There's no free clinic, even though like over 90% of these kids are on free and reduced lunches. There's no emergency room. So you know, when medical issues come up, these kids bring these things up with their teachers and principals at the schools. And so it's really incumbent upon the schools to try to figure out ways to help all of these kids. I also wanted to agree with what Deborah said. All of the kids I talked to actually did really seem happy in Noel, living in Noel, and they did seem like they were, you know, beginning to integrate pretty well. And when I talked to older residents, they said, yeah, the kids don't have problems. It's really the adults that see color is something I heard from a couple different people.
Huh. Are there some advantages for immigrant and refugee kids being in a rural area rather than an urban area?
That's a good question. I don't know about that. I haven't thought too much about that. Do you have any thoughts, Deborah?
Well, my thought on that is that there may be more opportunities for the children in rural areas to be involved because, for example, the football teams need as many people as they need, or the sports teams, and certainly they've created soccer in rural areas, or not created, but brought with them the love for soccer. And so they just have more opportunities to be involved than they would in an urban setting. I think there are probably more opportunities to be involved in not such good gatherings in an urban setting, where I think there are less opportunities for that in a rural setting.
And until now, we haven't talked about immigration status, but I know, Abby, you've looked into that some. How does that make a difference in terms of kids' futures? Some of the young people you talk to are here legally, and some of them are undocumented.
Yeah, the first cut in the montage was from an 18-year-old high school senior, Oscar, who I interviewed. He's undocumented. His mother brought him to Knoll when he was 2 years old to work at the Tyson plant. And when I talked to him, you know, he said he would be the first person in his family to go to college. But the problem with undocumented students, as most of your listeners already know, is that most colleges require social security numbers to apply, and certainly any federal aid that might be available is not is for the most part not available without a social security number. So undocumented kids who are of college age can apply for deferred action for childhood arrival status, which would allow them, if they get it, to stay here for at least 2 years. And then immigration reform advocates are hoping that one day the DREAM Act will pass, which would provide a path for legal citizenship. But it's definitely for kids that I talk to whose parents brought them here to work at the plant who are undocumented, options are very limited, at least for furthering their education.
And yeah. Abby Fentress-Swanson, I know that you need to leave us now. She's a reporter for KBIA and Harvest Public Media. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's been a great thing to report on, and I hope that we get to do some follow-up stories down the road.
And Deborah Bolton, I wonder, what do you see in Garden City in terms of the implications of immigration status on young people?
Well, you know, there were some students. I worked with a student who's during the when they had the when they had like a forgiving of, there was this time where you could get your children in under this act.
Right, that just recently that the Obama administration, well, is that right?
No, it was before the Obama, it was during the Clinton administration.
Oh, right, the amnesty then.
Amnesty, I couldn't remember the word. Anyway, and some parents didn't know that they were supposed to enroll their little children in that. And so I worked with a student that went all the way through school, and just about the time she was wanting to apply for college, she realized that her father had not enrolled her in the amnesty. He had enrolled himself, but he didn't know that he was supposed to enroll his infant child. And so she was born in Mexico, but came here in like at 6 months old. So she's still working on that process because she still wants to go to college, and this has been 7 years that she graduated. But there are a lot of disconnects in that system. Like, you can have your green card, but it runs out sometimes before you actually get to apply for citizenship, and there are just a lot of little breaks in the system that changes your status from having the proper authorization to not having the proper authorization. So we've worked with some students in that case. But on the other hand, I worked with a student this summer. She's an engineering student at K-State, and she was born in Mexico, came here at a very young age, and but is a DREAM Act student, but still paying. She was able to get her Social Security number and everything. She still doesn't have access to federal aid, but she does get scholarships because she's very bright. Mm. And we have a lot of cases of students who are just very bright, but just the system doesn't always work for them to go beyond high school or sometimes even finish high school.
And we have a call here from Nancy in Eudora. She called 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, yeah. What I'm wondering is, do they believe that they are doing things that Americans will not, people who've been here all their lives and have their citizenship, that do they believe they are doing things, working at things that we won't? Because as a child, my mother and I, for a living, we dressed chickens, and we did it without running water and without all the conveniences that they have in the packing plant. So, you know, it's just not true that Americans won't do those jobs. And then my mother went to work in a very contaminated defense plant and stood on her feet through three wars.
Right. Well, thank you, Nancy, for that comment. I want to see if, Deborah, that is something that you mentioned and something that we often hear, that there are immigrants in these communities because there's not enough Americans that will take these jobs.
Well, not enough U.S. Americans. The immigrants that are coming are from the Americas. So I just want to clear that part up. But we are, if you come to Southwest Kansas or any deeply agricultural community, they say the same things. I'm hearing this from owners that we do interviews with, and these are owners of large agricultural, like dairies and stuff. They just can't seem to find other people to do the work. And you might say other people to do the work at that wage. And that's been something that's brought up too. But, and also, when you were dressing chickens without water, you probably didn't have the regulations that people have today. They're pretty highly regulated, any of the agricultural institutions that are producing food. So you do have to have running water. But, yeah, my own parents were migrant farm workers at one time and worked in not great conditions, but again, I'm not saying that no U.S. American will do that, but we just are not having an easy time finding the people that do that. They don't stay very long.
Deborah, what role do the meatpacking plants, in this case in Garden City, Tyson, and Noel, Missouri, too, what role do they play in taking care of the kids of their workers, particularly immigrant and refugee workers?
I haven't seen that they do. Now, I know, like, for example, the packing plant in Finney County really supports United Way and really helps their workers be philanthropists, which they naturally are. But I suppose they feel like they support in an indirect way by supporting something like United Way.
Well, Deborah Bolton, we'll have to end it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Deborah Bolton is a family life educator at Kansas State University Research and Extension. You can read or listen to the stories in Harvest's three-part series In the Shadows of the Slaughterhouses and see photos of the young people interviewed on our website, kcur.org. Coming up after the break, a new website tracks gifts made by lobbyists to Missouri legislators. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. What's the best way to get free tickets to the next Bruno Mars concert or Cardinals game? Or how about a really nice dinner in Jefferson City? Become a state legislator in Missouri. It's one of the few states in the country where state reps can accept unlimited personal gifts and campaign contributions from lobbyists. And now there's a website that makes it easy for Missouri residents to see what gifts their state reps are accepting and from whom. LobbyingMissouri.org is the brainchild of Chris McDaniel, a political reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. He joins us now from a studio across the state. Thanks for coming on to KC Currents, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Sylvia.
So why did you decide to focus on this issue?
Well, it originally started about 7 or 8 months ago when I was interested in taking a closer look at the gifts that lobbyists were giving Missouri lawmakers. I wanted to take a closer look, but there was really no easy way to compare all of the gifts and who was giving them. The Missouri Ethics Commission has it on their site, but in order to access it, you have to go to a drop-down menu to another drop-down menu to another drop-down menu. And there are some problems with that, and there's really no easy way to compare it. So St. Louis Public Radio made this project where we could compare what everyone was receiving and where it was all coming from. After we launched that project, we were really interested in sort of taking it to the next level, and that's when we reached out to NPR's apps team, and they were very eager to work with us on it, and that's how we came up with LobbyingMissouri.org.
And now you have a searchable database, so people can look up what kind of gifts their lawmakers are getting.
That's right. So one of the things that I really like about the site is that you don't have to know who your state representative or state senator is. I would like to think that a lot of our listeners know who their state representative or state senator is, but I've looked at the surveys, and I know that they don't. So you can just type in your address, and it'll tell you who your state senator and state representative is, and it'll tell you – you can go to their page, and their page contains a lot of different information. It'll show you their picture, and it'll also show you how much they've received within the past 2 years and how much they've received since 2004, which is how far our data goes back.
And we have your database up on our website right now. It's called Lobbying Missouri. It's at kcur.org if people want to go ahead and test it out. All of this is public information, right?
That's correct.
And can you give me a sense of the magnitude of gifts here? How many gifts is it and how much money is it?
Well, it's tens of thousands of gifts. Within the past – if we talk about it from this year – this year, there was over $800,000 spent by lobbyists on Missouri lawmakers. And those are just for gifts. And I should probably clarify what a gift is and what we mean when we say a gift. We're not talking about campaign contributions. We're not talking about money. But gifts can be a lot of different things. Oftentimes, they're for meals. They're for lobbyists to take out legislators for expensive meals, for drinks. They can also be Cardinals tickets or Royals tickets if you're in Kansas City. They can be for pretty much anything. For Missouri's ethics system, there's really no limit as to what a gift can be.
And so most of them, you said, are like dinners or baseball or concert tickets. But there's some unusual things there, like flowers on Mother's Day for all of the women in the legislature. And I mean, what else did you think was kind of interesting or amusing?
Yes, there are a lot of things that will stick out to you. Just some really weird gifts. I noticed that one lawmaker, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she received a Valentine's Day cupcake valued at $5. So it really runs the gamut from, you know, gifts that, you know, cost up to, you know, thousands of dollars to gifts that are just a few dollars. Some of the other things that are weird, one lawmaker every month was getting a couple hundred dollars worth of jelly beans for his office.
Really?
and that took place over the span of at least 2 months, possibly 3 months. So if you go through and explore the data that we have on the site, you'll find a lot of weird things on there.
There's a lot of golf trips, right? And I mean, is there travel too?
Yes, travel is included. And as far as golf, it really just kind of reinforces the stereotype of, you know, a lawmaker making the decisions out on a golf course while, you know, talking with a lobbyist and, you know, having a beer, presumably. But it just kind of reinforces that stereotype that, in this case, according to the data, is true.
And are Missouri legislators really big Bruno Mars fans in particular?
Apparently so. Apparently, at least a few of them are. Bruno Mars wasn't the only concert, though. There was also a John Mayer concert that was just a few months ago in St. Louis that was apparently a big hit with Senate President Pro Tem Tom Dempsey was one of the ones who went there. I can't speak as to whether or not that was for one of his children, perhaps, but...
Interesting. Now, who are the biggest lobbyists here?
Well, that's a good question, and that's something that's really important because you want to know who the biggest receivers are, but you also need to know, well, who's trying to influence them here. So the biggest lobbyist for the past 24 months is Ameren, a utility company. They've spent nearly $100,000 in just the past 24 months. The second biggest lobbyist is the Missouri Hospital Association. So they're also a really big lobby, a really important lobby. The healthcare industry itself is a huge lobby. Within the past 24 months, they've given more than $250,000 in lobbyist gifts.
And what issues would you think they're concerned with? I guess, you know, energy and healthcare policy. Specifically, what's the legislature looking at that deals with those issues?
That's a really wonderful question. And that's something that doesn't always have a really clear answer. So the lobbyists are supposed to disclose twice to the Missouri Ethics Commission what issues they're lobbying on, what sort of bills they're lobbying on. Unfortunately, in those disclosures, it's not always clear. I can recall from looking through some of the disclosures that a lobbyist will say, we are lobbying on the issues that positively impact Missouri, and we are lobbying against the issues that negatively impact Missouri. So it doesn't really tell you what bills they're lobbying on. As far as the Missouri Hospital Association and the healthcare industry, a huge issue for them is Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm. Now, our reporter, Steve Bell here at KCUR, did a series on lobbying about a year ago, and he also found that some of the lobbyists are lobbying through a lobbying agency, so their names aren't necessarily listed on this public disclosure. Is that what you find?
That's definitely a huge issue. You'll find that, for example, one of the 10 biggest lobbyists is John Barger and Associates. They're a lobbying firm. So when they go out and they give a lawmaker a gift, they source it as going to their as being from their lobbying firm as opposed to whichever business they're representing. So it's kind of hard to suss out exactly where all the influence is coming from.
And in some cases, I think you can see, because some of these lobbying firms just represent one industry. For example, I mean, he found that the NRA and insurance companies were two of the major donors, but through lobbying firms.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few different problems with the way lobbying is done in Missouri. I feel comfortable saying that. One of the problems is also disclosure in terms of who is receiving these gifts. So there are two ways to disclose a lobbyist gift. One is by saying, I took this specific lawmaker out for a dinner. Here's his name. The other way is to say, I took this group out to a dinner. So that could be the House Minority Caucus, the House Majority Caucus. It could be a lot of different things. It could be a committee in the House or the Senate. And when that happens, you don't have to name the specific lawmakers that actually partook in that gift. And that's completely legal within Missouri's lobbying system. You don't even have to prove that you invited all the members of the group, although the only rule is you're supposed to invite all the members of the group. Missouri Ethics Commission does not ask for that proof, though.
Now, the big question, who is getting the most gifts from lobbyists in the Missouri legislature?
So one of the things that our site does is rank them out, one through 197, 197 being, you know, how many members we have in the House and the Senate. We try to make it all on an even keel by just doing the past 24 months so that we're not comparing for all time, so we don't have a freshman representative going up against, you know, an incumbent senator who's been in the House for 10 years. So for the past 2 years, we found that two Kansas City area lawmakers are at the top, Senator Kiki Curls and Senator Ryan Silvey. Senator Curls has accepted $22,000 in lobbyist gifts, and Senator Silvey has accepted $21,000 in lobbyist gifts. Now, that's only for the past 2 years. If you look on our site, in the past 10 years, Senator Silvey has accepted $52,000, which is the most out of anyone. So this isn't a small amount of money, really, when you look at it on a grand scale. To compare it to their legislative salary, I believe their stipend from the state is only $38,000. So you're talking about money that is comparable to what they're getting from the state.
Is there any pattern to the biggest recipients of gifts? Do they tend to be urban or rural legislators, Republican or Democrats?
You know, that's a really good question. I feel most comfortable speaking about specifically this session because that's what I've looked at most closely. And I can say that a lot of the spending is tied to the urban areas. Now, that could be for a lot of different reasons, one of which it's kind of interesting that now recently a lot of the power is tied to the urban areas. You even have, you know, Republican leadership who is from the St. Louis area, St. Louis you know, county area or St. Charles County area, but still tied to a large metropolitan area. So that's one reason that could explain it, is more power tied to urban areas. The other is, of course, that's where the lobbyists are located. They aren't located throughout the state, really. They're located in urban areas, and that's where you can get the Cardinals baseball tickets, the Royals baseball tickets. That's where the concerts are taking place. So that those could explain why this phenomenon occurs.
Now, defenders of this system, the lobbying system in Missouri, say it's okay because it's easy to find out who's getting and receiving gifts, and you're making it even easier. So if there's transparency in lobbying, is it okay?
Well, I think that there are a couple different arguments at place. One is, should lobbying like this occur? And then the other argument is, if it is going to occur, it should be as open as possible. So we've tried to make it as open as possible for everyone. We think that we've made it much more open than it has been. Lobbying is definitely an important thing for the Missouri legislature, especially when you have term limits, which gives much more power to the lobbyists, because when you look at who has been in the Missouri legislature the longest, who served in Jefferson City the longest, it's not the state representative, it's not the state senator, it's the lobbyist who's been there for much longer than the term limits would allow for a representative or a senator to be.
And how long are you going to continue tracking this?
So we started this in March, I believe, and the idea was that we would continue doing this, you know, for as long as we possibly could. With this help from the NPR Apps team, we plan on keeping it going for as long as possible. We don't have an end date. We plan on keeping updating it as long as the information is pertinent. And it seems like it's going to be pretty pertinent for a long time.
And on that note, what is the likelihood of the system changing? It's been a big issue for the former Kansas City area state representative Jason Kander, who's now Secretary of State. Will there be a charge to change Missouri's lobbying system to tighten up the rules in the next session?
It's unlikely, but it's possible. There were a couple of bills last session that would have either limited or done away with completely gifts from lobbyists, and those two bills didn't even receive a hearing. There are some who are calling for ethics reform, but it's unclear if they'll be able to be successful. I know that Representative McManus has been calling for it from over in the Kansas City area, as well as Senators Scott Sifton in St. Louis and Senator John Lamping from the St. Louis area. But in order for it to be successful, it has to be first called to the floor, which it isn't clear if leadership would allow it.
Chris McDaniel is a political reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You can check out the Lobbying Missouri database on our website. If you live in Missouri, you can enter your address and find out what kind of gifts your state reps are receiving. Veterans Day is coming up on Monday. It's a time to remember the sacrifice that people who've served in our armed forces have made. But there's a post office in Overland Park that honors veterans all year long. The Brookridge Post Office at 97th and Antioch has displayed photos of veterans, past and present, from local families on its walls for almost 10 years now. The photos go back all the way to the Civil War, and the display keeps getting bigger. KCUR's Beth Lipoff reports.
You've always got something to look at when you wait in line at the Brookridge Post Office. From Civil War to current active duty personnel, the photos on the wall show members of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard.
This is a good kind of picture to have in a post office. Yeah. You know, they used to have the wanted ones years ago. They don't do that anymore.
About 9 years ago, postal worker Shirley Worley decided to celebrate veterans for a month each year. She started with pictures of her family. Then customers started giving her their photos.
Hearing some of the stories from different people, we decided that we used to decorate the lobby different seasons and stuff all the time, so we decided to do the Veterans Day and make it something where we would honor the people in our community that we see all the time.
She retired 4 years ago after 39 years with the Postal Service. She took the photos with her when she left. But then she got a call from her former coworker, Vivian Pearson.
I had them and I didn't want to throw them away or anything. I just couldn't do that. And so I just kept them. And then she called and she says, by, you know, October, yeah. People are saying, when are you putting the pictures up? When are you putting the pictures up?
Pearson has been at Brookridge for 20 years. She became the point person for the project when Worley left. Now the photos are up year-round and the collection's growing. Each photo goes up with the name of the person and the dates and branch of their service.
Last time I counted, I had 153 pictures. And I used to, before I laminated them, I would write the names down and put a number on the back of it and laminate it. But I'm getting them in so fast, I'm just laminating them and putting them up here. So I'm guessing there's probably over 200 pictures up here now.
Her nephew, Julian Butler, is a Marine. His picture is on the wall, along with one of her father, who served in Vietnam. Many veterans from Worley's family are on the wall, from her husband to a relative who fought in the Civil War. One section celebrates local postal workers who have served in the military. Worley remembers many of the other people as regulars at Brookridge.
Jaffers was a customer. this guy's a customer, Mr. Allen. The other guy was a customer. He used to work here. That's his brother. Don't know that one. He used to be a customer.
One regular, Harvey Bayless, is one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. William Allen served in the Army for 10 years and was a survivor of the Bataan Death March. He died last year.
Mr. Allen, him and his wife used to come in all the time. And, you know, they would tell us stories about, you know, his survival. She was a nurse, and that's, I don't know if that's where they met or not.
Vivian Pearson does her best to encourage more people to participate.
We have a lot of customers that come in with those military hats on, and I try to talk them into bringing me a picture. Some do, some don't.
Not everyone likes to talk about their military service, even if they do have their photo on the wall.
I don't know if a lot of them even like remembering that stuff, especially the Vietnam vets. They don't seem to want to talk too much, especially like my father. He doesn't talk too much about Vietnam. Because, you know, they just didn't treat it the best when they came back. So, especially if it's a Vietnam vet, I try to make sure to thank them a little extra.
Many service members are so proud of the display, they share it with others. Often, they get their picture taken next to the display and bring family members in to see it. With the older veterans, Worley tries to see how the photo and the person in front of her match up.
It's interesting to see when they give you a picture of themselves when they were, you know, 18 or 20 or something. They're standing in front of you in their 60s, 70s, you know, 80s. To see, it's like, okay, I think I can see this guy in there somewhere.
Worley makes a copy of each display she puts on the wall for the family. One veteran was too frail to come by and see the wall. His family hung their copy in his nursing home room. Worley says the display is a reminder of what veterans have done.
You forget, unless it's Veterans Day and you have the holiday off, but this is a visual. And you come in and you may see your neighbors or someone that you live next to, someone you're standing in line next to, and you're not realizing the contribution that they made to the country.
So the next time you're waiting to buy a stamp at Brookridge, take a look at the photos. You might find yourself standing next to a veteran. For Casey Currents, I'm Beth Lipoff.
See some of those images of veterans from the Brookridge Post Office at 97th and Antioch on our website at kcur.org. That's it for Casey Currents today. Our live broadcast is now every Thursday morning. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or subscribe to the podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents. Central Standard returns tomorrow with the Movie Critics. Next on Up to Date, a discussion of what the future holds for school kids in Kansas City, Missouri. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Alex Smith, and Susan Wilson. Our interns are Esther Honig, Ross Steinmetz, and Sydney Llewellyn. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.